Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Joshua James Amberson, author of the new book, Staring Contest, Essays About Eyes, from Portland's Perfect Day Publishing. Joshua's writing includes the novel How to Forget Almost Everything, a series of chapbooks from Two Plum Press, and the long-running zine series Basic Paper Airplane. His work has appeared in the Los Angeles Review of Books, The Rumpus, The Seattle Times, Electric Literature, Tin House, and the Portland Mercury, among others. Joshua served as events coordinator for Portland's Independent Publishing Resource Center, co-hosted the Steer podcast, and operates the Antiquated Future online store and record label. He also teaches writing classes privately and through Portland Community College's Community Education Program. Author Justin Hocking writes of Staring Contest, "These essays are at once inquisitive, vulnerable, humorous, and deeply humane. While sharing his experience with a chronic illness that threatens his vision, Amberson also interrogates the way we as a culture privilege the sense of sight, especially in our image-saturated present moment. Staring Contest is a revelation. Readers will never again experience the world in quite the same way." Please join us for our conversation with Joshua James Amberson, which is already in progress. Joshua, thanks for joining us today in the KBOO studios, and I think you've been here before recording your podcast, The Steer, back in the pre-COVID days.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be back.
Welcome home.
Yeah, thank you. It feels like home. It's so cozy.
Well, let's start with the event that led to the book, Staring Contest, which is also the subject of the first essay in the book, and that's Hazy. Around the age of 12, you were diagnosed with a rare disease called pseudoxanthoma elasticum, or PXE, which I'll refer to it as, because that is kind of a tongue twister. The condition causes cracks in your retina, and if a blood vessel enters that crack, it could result in hemorrhaging and bleeding and vision loss. And that led you on a quest to find a cure, or at least an effective treatment. And doctors you saw knew so little about it. One doctor told you, "You'll either never be affected by it or someday you'll go blind." And that's really not much to go on. What'd you feel at that point?
It really wasn't a lot to go on. And I think just the fact that it was so open-ended gave me an excuse or just to not think about it, I think. And to be a teenager about it, to just
ignore it. I'm going to live forever.
Yeah, I'm going to live forever. And yeah, bury any emotions I had around that piece of information. And there's a lot more that they know now. And in large part, thanks to PXE International, which
you write an essay on them in the book.
Yeah,
they refer to themselves as Pixies.
Pixies, yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, which I just think is so cute.
I love
that I'm a Pixie. Yeah, proud to be. And it's a DC-based advocacy, international advocacy group for PXE, and they've funded a lot of the research that's got us to the point of knowledge that we have now. But at this time, this was the mid-90s, and there was just very, very little information. And something that comes up in the book is it's really affected me. It's affected my retinas. And I didn't learn until many years later that it affects the whole body. It's a calcification of the tissue in the body. And so a lot of people don't have problems with their eyes. They have problems with their legs and being able to get proper blood flow to their extremities. And some of this I might have even learned at the time, but it was so focused on the eyes that that I put all of that to the side. And so...
You were treated just for the eyes. You found out that injections directly in the eye could help. And at the time, they cost $1,000 per shot. So you're now at the mercy of the American medical system, where people can go bankrupt if they don't have adequate health insurance. And you write, aside from going blind, debt is my greatest fear. So you're faced with this double whammy of a possible vision loss, loss of money, of going broke. How did you at least get some financial relief at that time?
Yeah, so when I started getting injections was my mid-20s, so it was 10 or 12 years after my diagnosis, and it was really early, which is something I don't think I make clear in the book, because in part it's just not essential to the story, but a lot of people with PXE don't end up having hemorrhages until their 40s or 50s or 60s, and some never have hemorrhages at all. So even among PXE patients, I was an oddity at that time. So having them in my mid or, I can't remember the exact first year, I've been trying to place it, but I think I was 26 when I had my first hemorrhage. But that was really young, and it was really young for any retinal eye-related condition.
Right, you're right. It's the same medication that's used for the wet type of macular degeneration, which usually affects only older people.
Yeah.
Maybe 75, 80 and older.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And not often that's referred to as simply age-related macular degeneration, because it's so so common among older folks. And so, especially in those early years, I was sharing the waiting room with much,
you're the
much
youngest
older,
one in there.
Yeah, by many decades, and
everybody's grandkid.
Yes, yeah, yeah, and I looked even younger than I was at the time. So I stuck out there, and I got really lucky. The clinic was doing those initial injections. I was able to get an emergency financial relief fund.
So you weren't paying that $1,000
yes,
a shot.
Yeah.
So with the finances taken care of, or at least mollified, you now are facing the injection in the eye, and you write quite a bit about that in the book. Your eye is clamped open for the injection, and it's like something out of Little Alex in A Clockwork Orange.
Yeah.
And the eye is numbed a bit, but you're wide awake for the injection. And you write in the book that you prepared for it by watching not Clockwork Orange, but another movie with a very, an emotionally draining scene about an eye, and that's Un Chien Andalou. So it's 1929 short by Salvador Dali and Luis Buñuel, one of his first movies. And the famous scene, of course, is a man taking a straight razor across a woman's eye and slitting it. And that's how you actually prepared for it. You watched that scene, you said, over and over before the first injection. Did that work? It was kind of almost a homeopathic way of doing it, huh?
Yeah. It sort of did work. It didn't really matter once I was getting my first injection. It didn't work for that. But it gave me some confidence in a certain way.
It couldn't be as bad as all this.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. At
as
least,
in the movie.
At least that's not happening to me. So, in a certain way it did. And at least for those initial years, the finances remained a problem, even though there was no clear, because the hemorrhages happened at that point so irregularly and oftentimes they're happening most of a year apart at that point. And so I didn't know if I was going back to that same clinic a year later that they would honor that. And then when I moved, that was when I was in the Olympia area. And when I moved to Portland, I didn't have that situation. I didn't know. So I was always applying for some funding at some specialty clinic somewhere.
Again, the American medical system.
Yes,
how to get by.
Yeah.
And of course, that was the origin of the book. you're a very productive writer, and I've read quite a bit in preparation and in a range of forms, essays, articles, reviews, zines, short fiction, the novel even, How to Forget Almost Everything, which also has some basis in your own life, some autobiographical elements. And I was wondering why you decided to tell the stories as a series of connected essays rather than a memoir or maybe even fiction.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, essays are what I come back to the most. It's where I feel the most at home. And yeah, it took a little bit of convincing for me to understand that this was a book. I'd written a couple essays that were touching on different aspects of PXE and my
experience. Was Hazy the first one?
Hazy was a really early one. I can't remember. Some of these were different essays, and then I adapted. I sort of took chunks of them and then wrote a new essay off of that or so. Looking back, it was hard for me to identify or remember which one was the seed of it. What the very initial one was 10 years ago, and some elements of that became Hazy. And Hazy was probably about 6 or so years ago. And but I think that was maybe the first full essay. But I wrote that and the essay The Blind Cartoon, which
we'll talk about, with Mr. Magoo.
Which uses Mr. Magoo as sort of a way into this material. I think those were the two that I had completed. And a few different people were saying, a lot of people were saying, this seems like a memoir. And I was very resistant to that because I don't think it's not a memoir storyline. It's not, I was really living, like a lot of writers, writing from a place of in-betweenness. I was still fully fully in the world of the sighted, but there were threats to that along the way that I was navigating. And so to me, something much bigger would have had to happen for it to be a memoir, and I didn't want something bigger to happen. To me, that just wasn't a memoir story. And what was interesting to me was being at that intersection and writing from that place. And that's what finally convinced me, was people saying, you have a unique position that you're living from and writing from, and that's the book there. It's not the big narrative line. Once people started saying, think thematically about this.
Yes, at the Powell's launch, book launch, mm-hmm. you said that you regarded that as a gift.
Yeah.
To start thinking thematically about vision loss.
Yeah, and that really excited my brain, because then it wasn't all about me. There's a lot of personal in this, and maybe more than I acknowledge in my head even, because I think of a lot of the side subjects.
But there's
and
a
research.
Lot of history. There's a lot of cultural reference.
And that's what comes to mind for me when I think of this as a book. I think of all these side roads, sort of these thematic side roads that I took along the way.
And those side roads, you mentioned that when you got that gift of thinking thematically, you started brainstorming a list of topics all on the theme. I was amazed just in the book at the number and the range of topics. And then you mentioned a few, I think in the preface, you mentioned a few that you didn't include: the social politics of winking, the history of eye charts, the emotional impact of overhead lighting, which still sound interesting to me. So how did you decide which of those topics to pursue and which ones to kind of leave for later or ignore entirely?
I tried to pursue all of them, but some just didn't work out. I've always had, I want to say, an issue, but it's maybe not strong enough to be an issue. But I've just noticed how much my mood changes with the lighting in a room. And so that's one I want to write someday, but I just couldn't figure out how to get into it. Some of these essays, I really let myself write into how I was actually feeling at the time, which was in many of these situations, really a little more woe is me than I like to be in everyday life. But I wanted to reflect what I was actually feeling during that time period. But that one, when I was trying to draft it, felt a little too, I couldn't get into what was interesting, and I was stuck in this felt like a loop of overhead lights bother me in some way.
But maybe to be continued.
But yeah, some of them I just couldn't quite figure out. And there are a lot of interesting ones when you get into representations of blindness in popular media and literature, and like the blind seer archetype.
Tiresias and
the blind, often, you know, character in a film that
sees everything.
And I got a little ways into that one, and but some of those I just felt like they weren't my story to tell. They weren't, that I wasn't the person to do it. And especially when I started reading so many blind writers, or several blind writers at least, that were doing work like that. And so some of them, I got a little ways down the path and then said, this is interesting, I'm glad I know about it, but I'm not the one to tell this story, someone else is. And so maybe two or three essays I was considering, or ones that might morph into each other perhaps and be one essay, some of those I swept to the side because of that. And then some, you know, is an interesting history, but I never surprised myself in the writing process. And that's something that's really, really important to me in the essay process, especially, is that I want it to go somewhere that I'm not expecting. I want my thinking to evolve on the page. And if that doesn't happen and I'm just reiterating research, then that's not an essay to me. You know, it's a book report. It's a film review. If I don't get to that point of something in me changed in the process of writing it, then it just got cut out.
Now, before we get to the topics themselves, well, we mentioned a few and we'll delve into some a little deeper. I should mention there are four types of essays in the book. There's the brief histories, a catalog, a conversation series, and I think kind of a more general essay such as Hazy, which doesn't have a subtitle, any of those categories. Were these forms you worked in before? Did they come about while writing the individual essays and maybe seen some of the connections between a few of the essays and say, oh, this is part of a series?
Yeah, it was definitely in the process. Something like the catalog series, catalogs, subtitle, are more of what often gets called a collage-style essay, more fragmented. And I'd worked in essays like that before, but I'd never had as much purpose around them. And once I saw that it could be useful for a few of the subjects, I let those evolve naturally at first, where once I saw that I had a few different types I was working in.
You could just give them that label, but you wrote them without necessarily having that in mind, that they're part of the series.
Yeah, yeah. Aside from a conversation series, which I went into as a series, a brief history and a catalog, those came out of the writing process. And then I saw that as a way to both help myself organize the material and alert something to the reader and give some signals and some a little bit of hand holding, since I knew that I was trying to do a lot in it and really take the reader a lot of different places. I didn't want it to be a book that was completely challenging, or I didn't want to put too. I was very conscious, or tried to be very conscious of how much work I was asking of the reader, and the subtitles helped relieve some of that tension, some of my worry, I guess. Some of the
reader knows what they're in for with right away, but I didn't find any of it tedious or demanding.
That's good.
As a reader, it was very entertaining.
That's great. Yeah, and I just knowing that they wouldn't exactly know what those subtitles meant the first time around, but hopefully that would alert them
on
the second. Then they would catch on once it got going and you saw, this is something that's coming back around a few times.
Yeah. Now, as someone who does interviews, I caught on right away to the conversation series essays. Yeah. And these are excerpts from conversations you had with legally blind artists and writers, all in their own words, and you left out your part of the conversation, so it's just their words. There are four interviewees, writer and performer Leona Godin, novelist Keith Rawson, writer-podcaster Andrew Leland, and a blind comic artist, M. Sabine Rear. How did this series develop, and how did you choose who to talk with?
Yeah, it came out of some of the essays I was leaving out, where I worried that I was telling stories that weren't mine to tell, like I said before.
Oh, so good stories that the interviewees can tell because it's their experience.
Obviously, they didn't get to these subjects, or I didn't push them to the subjects that I had been looking into, but just that I realized I was trying in some places to write from the perspective of blindness while being sighted, and that I wanted, I as someone who interviews people or has interviewed people a lot in the past, it was just a natural inclination to say, hey, let's bring some other people on board that can speak more personally and bring in perspectives that I would never come up with on my own because they're not my lived experience. And there was already something, and there were more, I hope, or I don't think that it's a quote packed book, but there were more quotes than in any other series of essays I've ever written before, just bringing in a lot of voices. So there was, I already felt, at least in the writing process, there felt like there was a polyphonic quality to it, where there were a lot of different voices coming and joining me in it. And so I thought, why not just take that one step further and really, and have these quote unquote essays that were fully not in my voice, and that I was just the editor or engineer for, that I was editing.
Well, you also
down
probably and, were asking the right questions. Yeah. I mean, to get such good material from your interviewees.
Yeah, oh, thank you. Yeah, and they were all so generous with their time and actually the work they put into it. I unlike something like a piece I would do for a journal or a magazine, I sent my drafts to them, and I edited down drafts and said, how's this sitting for you? You know, and so they each of them read a couple drafts and sent back comments, and we had a second conversation series just about whittling it down and making something we both felt good about. And so they were all so generous, and I chose them in part because they'd all written things that had
Oh, about being legally blind.
Yeah, or... About the experience of blindness that had really opened my mind in different ways and made me think about things that I hadn't been thinking about. And so there were a couple other people I asked to who were interested but weren't able to make time for it. And so I wanted it to be an even bigger part of the book, but I, you know, it was that in itself is having four in there is in and of itself, even though they're short, a little bit of a risk. So I think it ended up being the right number, but especially Emliona Godin and Andrew Leland both had written a lot. And Andrew Leland's podcast, The Organist, he'd done many episodes or several episodes about vision related blindness, vision loss related experiences and subjects, and that had just been so helpful. And so those two were just, they topped my list because, and Leona had done a series for Catapult called, I think, The Blind Artist's Notebook. And that was, she started that shortly after I'd started this book project. So I was reading those as they were coming out and just learning so much with each one and mixing personal experiences and history and the arts into this. So that was a big part of it too, was I asked a lot of questions about process and things. I try not to push any of them into how do you do this on a technical level, but how do you work as an artist? And just wanted to, I think the thing that comes up most around artists and writers who are blind is this, how do you do it in a very physical, practical way? And
we would always be curious about that.
Yeah, yes. And there's nothing wrong with that curiosity, but as M. Sabine Rear says in her conversation series piece, you know, that people ask not necessarily the wrong question, but the less interesting question. Mm-hmm. And that really, I wanted readers to take away that these writers and artists are working just like any other writers and artists, that the physical limitations of their process are not the most interesting part of their process. Right. And that's something that I couldn't have brought just on my own.
Right.
And so it felt good. I hope it, you know, now that the book's out, it feels good to everyone who is involved with it too, that I handed some of that work over to them, you know, and it's a really, to me, I've done a number of printed Q&As in newspapers and magazines, mm-hmm. and journals, where I think most readers don't know how much a printed Q&A is edited and often changed, you know, that a lot of things are, there's a pretty heavy editing hand in printed Q&As.
Yeah, thank God for that.
Yeah, right. I know. But it was shocking to me when I realized that is just par for the course across most publications.
Yes.
And so I don't think I push it as far in a lot of my Q&As as some writers or editors do already, but it's an immensely creative act to me. And I've written a couple oral history pieces, and that act of finding just the right quote and or boiling down a really engaging in-person conversation to capture that on the page,
right,
through the act of editing it just feels so exciting.
I think it is an art.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is. And So I just felt so creatively involved in those pieces, even though I wasn't adding any words at any point. So it's just an act of subtraction. And yeah.
So I wanted to get to the list itself, the ones that are in the book.
Yeah.
And it's vast.
Okay, that's good.
Just a partial list to give listeners a taste. Eye patches, pirates, Lisa Left Eye Lopes, glasses, slacker movies, The Bates Method, Mr. Magoo, which we mentioned, photography and cameras, Borges, James Joyce, Milton, Bette Davis, Descartes, Stevie Wonder, Helen Keller, maybe two of the more obvious topics, King Lear, Oedipus, Cinderella, crying tears, staring at and staring with, typewriters, which you have an affection for, a collection, a health and sickness and the fine line between them. It's just amazing to me how much of our culture revolves around sight and the fear of losing it.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that in that initial brainstorming list, the things that popped up right away, I really like the fact that so many people were involved in this book, especially, I say it never wasn't a book because I wasn't very far along by the time I decided it was a book project or was helped in that process. So many of the essays were published in various journals and had different editors on them and different writing groups. And so many people were involved. So I like now that I can give credit where credit's due, but something early on was, you know, someone said, what do you notice and think about that maybe other people don't? And a lot of the things on the list were things that that I realized as soon as she said that I'd maybe spent a little more time on or had been a little preoccupied with in a way that other people probably hadn't been. And
yeah, you mentioned even as a child, you kind of looking back, you had a prescience about vision loss and sight. There was one early memory from your childhood. You said you used to squint and cross your eyes to alter the reality you were seeing. And you describe it in the book as a spiritual experience, seeing things out of focus as a way of getting closer to the divine, closer to God. That amazes me because it's kind of like when you read about religious figures or saints and prophets having visions.
Right, yeah.
They're viewing an altered reality, whether they're squinting or rubbing their eyes or causing that altered reality themselves. There's something about this otherworldly vision that you were kind of attuned to at a very early age.
Yeah, I really felt like that. And this was, young in early elementary school, probably from preschool to into early elementary school, that I was really liked the act of blurring my vision and changing how I was seeing the world, and it felt like a practice.
To turn it into a spiritual or religious practice too.
Yeah.
Rather than just, oh, this is kind of neat. I'm seeing dots and colors and I'm seeing God.
I mean, there was an equal mix of the two, which was just like, oh, this is fun and weird. And in that essay, I refer to myself as an endlessly concerned child, which is maybe one of the best ways I've captured my younger self in language. not that I didn't have fun, but I overthought everything. You know, I spent a lot of time in my head, and I didn't, at least around people I didn't know or didn't know well, I didn't talk a whole lot. A lot was just being in my head, and trying to find meaning from things. And so I would go right for meaning, you know, oh, this is fun. This looks trippy. What does it mean? What is it? What am I getting out of this? And not just in a selfish sense, but what am I learning? How is this deepening the world around me.
You could see the roots of the book.
Yeah, right.
And the grown up Joshua in this childhood experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think I just described an archetypal essayist right there in my when describing my younger
someone who's endlessly concerned,
yeah, always in their head, always overthinking everything, searching for meaning at every possible turn.
Now, one topic on the list, and you write a whole essay about it called The Blind Cartoon, which we alluded to earlier. It takes off on Mr. Magoo, the cartoon series, and the history of it. I was fascinated by it because I grew up watching those cartoons. I never found them particularly funny, probably entertaining, but I mean, I would watch anything on TV when I was a kid.
Me too.
So, but I didn't realize how offensive they could be to someone with low vision. In effect, you're making fun of somebody who's legally blind, and he's kind of the being victimized in a way, even though he's a cartoon figure. You went to the history, and what amazed me was you said the animators initially thought of Magoo, and this, I think the first cartoon came out in 1949, as a reaction against the Red Scare. Mm-hmm. And Senator Joe McCarthy in his House of Un-American Activities, a bad time in American history. I hope we don't return to it now.
Yeah, same.
And Magoo represents somebody lacking vision, like a McCarthyite, blind to his own prejudices. Is that how the Magoo cartoons were viewed initially? Because I never got the connection.
No, I don't know that anybody outside of other writers at the time working in the broader entertainment industry got that connection.
But you found a history there where the animators actually talked about that.
Talked about it, yeah. Yeah, and they were soon after, I think two of the original animators maybe more were, creators were blacklisted for a time.
Of course, because that was very common at the time.
So they knew it was coming for them. One interesting thing that I didn't get into the book because it is sort of a niche detail is one of those is Georgia Hubley, who's half of Yola Tango.
Her parents.
Her dad was one of those original creators.
Her dad and her mom, too, because the Hubleys were a husband-wife team.
Right.
Did a lot of great animation at that time, in the 50s.
Right, yeah. I don't know, maybe I forgot this, but I think her mom wasn't involved with Magoo, but her dad was. Uh-huh. And so that was just an interesting detail that, as someone who's really liked Yola Tango since for 20 years, I was like, that's a fun.
Yeah, and I didn't know that connection either. Yeah. I'm just thinking, what if there was congressional investigation with an actual, Joseph McCarthy interrogating Mr. Hubley?
Yeah, yeah.
This Magoo character, are you making fun of me?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's absurd in hindsight now.
Yeah.
Though it actually was a big part of America, a sad part of American history.
Yeah, very sad. Yeah.
Now, in the Magoo cartoons, of course, we're meant to find blindness funny, whether we do or not, something to laugh at. But the essays also reference blindness in myth and literature, even horror movies, even some grade B and C horror movies, as something to fear, blindness as punishment, as retribution, as vengeance. In the essay Poked in the Eye, you mentioned Oedipus, who gouged out his own eyes after killing his father and sleeping with his mother, and Shakespeare's King Lear, where blindness is both literal and figurative. That's a central theme of the book, of the play. And you even have a section on watching some very graphic horror movies, these low-grade movies, where characters are poked, stabbed, shot in the eye. I think you were doing that for research rather than entertainment value. Now, the eye violence seems to run in both high and low culture to an extent I didn't even realize until reading the essay. It seems that you're tapping into maybe one of our deepest fears, which a lot of horror movies do, damage to the eyes and blindness.
Yeah, yeah. And on some level, I was doing that research hoping to find another layer. And so one, it's not really a type of essay, but it's a type of essay writing experience for me. I often call those essays failure essays.
Why is that?
Where I go in with a particular purpose and a hope to find something, and it doesn't manifest in whatever way. And then the essay becomes the story of going through that and ultimately not being successful. And hopefully that's the interesting part, is that the journey rather than the end takeaway. And so that was one where I was like, it seems so simplistic to say that there's all this eye violence, like you say, both in high and low culture, simply because the sighted fear blindness so much. But in the end, I got to a point where I couldn't find that deeper layer, that it was really just the same.
As simple as it seems,
and the same fear manifesting again and again and again in artistic works. And in some ways, even though the level of gore is, you know, can vary a lot, as I found.
You talked about it. Yeah. The Italian series of horror movies with eye violence.
It's quite a bit. Yeah. And
very graphic.
Very graphic. So the level of how gory or graphic it gets has some range. It's essentially the same every time, right? Whether it's Shakespeare or
a
horror movie, it felt like it was coming back to just this same loss of control or loss of power in some instances. And
maybe what Shakespeare was getting at with the figurative meaning of mm-hmm. blindness.
Yeah.
King Lear, that was his fatal mistake.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are some sub fears within the fear of blindness that you can identify, but it felt like a lot of different manifestations of just this same fear playing out in artistic works over history or through history. And so I hoped it was more than that, you know. I hoped there was another level. And so that was a failure essay to me, that that I hope the journey was worth the lack of conclusion in some respect. I also give any readers permission to skip that one, because I've already
heard, if they're a little queasy,
I've already
getting
heard
a trigger warning.
Yeah, I've already heard from the publisher that one of his friends read it and said, I just had to skip that one. He said, oh, that's fine. You know, we expect that. So,
Joshua, you also talk in the book of eye contact as both intimidation and connection. Someone might try to stare us down as a warning or a threat, but staring can also help us connect with other humans and animals,
yeah,
as you do in the book. You mentioned the distinction between staring at and staring with. I wonder if you could talk about that, especially your own experiences. I remember three from the book. One, your high school girlfriend. Another, when you were working kind of as a nanny for a baby. You bonded with the baby by staring. This is mm-hmm. a 4.5-month-old infant. And then you have an elderly dog that was kind of, all the needs were met, but the dog kept staring, and you figured it out in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. There were two essays, one specifically on eye contact and one on staring, and trying to separate those. You know, there's a very fine line, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that when does eye contact, how long does eye contact last before it gets into staring?
Right, and when should you look away momentarily and back?
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of... And I sometimes question on things like that. I find little bits of in my research process that I just think are funny or a little absurd. And there's a lot of, when you get into eye contact advice, especially in the professional realm, you get a lot of what I thought was just very silly, timed
I've read some of those. Yeah, when you're trying to, as a salesperson,
yes.
About eye contact or negotiations, there's all sorts of theories presented as fact by a lot of these experts.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And as if it'll be comfortable to every single person in the exact same way. And there's a lot of half seconds in the advice.
you need the little stopwatch.
Hold their gaze for, I think, 3.5 seconds is a common one where it's, how do you even do it? How do you count a half second in your head? You know, how do you maintain eye contact and also count anything? You know, I don't know. It seems like a trick. And so a lot of those things, that was in one of the catalog pieces, was more fragmented or collage style. And I felt like maybe just leaving some of those quotes there with a little bit of my feelings on them, but not too much, might be a sort of dry humor way to get some of the absurdity in there of just, just how silly it is that we try to do this thing that should ostensibly be natural into this very unnatural thing. And then, but also, you know, later in that, also acknowledging how for a lot of people, it isn't natural and it doesn't feel comfortable.
And they'd like advice.
Yeah.
And maybe they're seeking it from the wrong people.
Yes, yes, yeah. But yeah, just also how good it can be to connect through the eyes too when it's mutual, when it's...
So in that case, it can be very natural. It's two people bonding and expressing their feelings wordlessly, silently to each other through their eyes. But it could also be used for manipulation, as we're talking, maybe advice to salespeople and things like that. Mm-hmm. So one of the funniest stories in the book, it was laugh out loud funny for me, it's in the essay Contact, a Catalog. And you talk about eye contact in there as a way of persuading and manipulating people. So that's kind of the dark side of eye contact. At that time, you were working in a bookstore in Olympia, Washington called Orca. And you were one of the used book buyers. And a guy comes in with a collection of books. Do you want to take it from there?
Yeah. Well, when I was working the used book buying table, I started to see these, and it's before I'd really started thinking about eye contact, this many years ago, but just that a lot of the eye contact advice books, many of them were very small press books or kind of business press books or things like that, things that...
like advice on how to persuade somebody or how to negotiate.
Yeah, things that... Today, you don't really even see in used bookstores anymore. They've sort of just vanished, but they were still around quite a lot in the aughts. And I would see these and at first I would think it was interesting because it's something as coming out of being very shy that eye contact was a little difficult for me. So sometimes I'd flip through them and I just had gotten to the point where I'm like, these are all so sleazy.
Some of them were like The Art of Seduction, weren't they?
Yeah.
If you're in a bar, how do you make eye contact with a man or a woman?
And
that's definitely sleazy.
yeah. And they all predate the pickup artist sort of culture, if you want to call it that. But... They're precursors to it in some cases where they really did have, you know, techniques, especially for picking up women in them. And so I sort of had a relationship with them that I wasn't so sure about them at that point. And then one day a guy brings in a whole grocery bag of them. He brings in a grocery bag, I sign him in, and I say, it'll be about 15, 20 minutes, and I go through them, and they're all on eye contact, just a whole bag of them.
He was specializing.
And he was very specialized. He'd really done a lot of research, and I just got frustrated, and it was rare that this happened, but every now and then there'd be a buy where I'm like, I'm not taking any of these. they're just, I don't even want to involve myself with this, these books, this person. And that happened. And it's not that they were so gross or blatant, but I just felt like they were all working toward the same purpose of manipulating someone through your eyes. And so I just put them all back, put zero on his little trade slip. And when he came back up to the buying table, I said, I'm sorry, we can't take any of these. He didn't say anything, and he just looked at me.
I love that.
I was so disarmed.
He was trying out all the techniques on you, huh?
Yeah. Oh, it was so confident, too. He was just...
almost like he wanted to hypnotize you into buying the books.
Yeah. I think I did question it. You know, I questioned my decision because it would have been different if he'd argued against it or, you know, been a real pushy or a jerk, then I would have doubled down, right? But something about just this disarming eye contact made me say, did I make the right decision? Was that a weird thing to do? And it really worked. And then when he left, I realized, oh, he just used the techniques from the books on me.
I know. But you didn't end up buying.
No, okay. I didn't go back on it, but I let him leave. But yeah, it did take him leaving for me to realize that he'd hit me with it, and it had worked. And so
he didn't get exactly what he wanted out of it, but he was getting close there.
No, yeah, but he did intimidate me a little bit. So, you know, I mean, on some level it worked. He didn't get what he wanted, but he did knock me off my feet.
So. Now, one of the joys of doing these interviews is showcasing the work of independent presses.
Yeah.
And Portland has a wealth of world-class ones. A staring contest comes to us from Perfect Day Publishing, which is run by Michael Heald. How did you connect with Michael, and what was the collaboration like on the book? He was pretty much involved, wasn't he?
He was very involved, yeah. And it was great. I've known Michael for a long time, and I've known Perfect Day. I moved to Portland just over 10 years ago, so 11 years ago.
And they're about 10 years old, too, huh?
Yeah, just a little over. And so they were new on the scene here, so it was one of the presses that I didn't know about before moving here that I found out about really early on, and that already had a lot of excitement around it. And Michael's just a really, really open person. And so, and one thing that was moving here from Olympia that doesn't always have the biggest writing community. It fluctuates a lot. It's a pretty transient town in some ways.
Well, certainly compared to Portland, which has a very solid and large writing community.
Yeah, and moving down here and having one foot here for many years before it, in part because of the writing community and coming for it, it just felt like Portland was very open about letting new people in, and Michael was one of those people that I felt right away was letting me into the world. And so,
which is kind of an honor, because I read that they're very discriminating. They usually publish just one work of creative nonfiction a year.
Yeah. So I'd never actually considered Perfect Day for this book or anything else. I just had an appreciation for them. I was a fan. And then one day I just was talking to Michael, and he said, you know, I wanted to do something a little different for their next book. And he listed off some qualities of a book that he would like. And
I thought, this sounds familiar.
I thought about it and I said, oh, this sounds a little like the manuscript I have. Or, you know, this manuscript was in a place of being done-ish for a few years, and I was just tinkering here and there, but I really needed an outside editor, someone beyond the editors for journals, someone who could look at it as a whole. And And so, yeah, I wrote Michael and I said, hey, if you want to take a look at this, our conversation made me think of it. And he wrote me back and very politely declined. Said, I'd like to read it as a friend, but I'm not really accepting submissions.
Oh, even before looking at it.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. And so I said, oh, yeah, that's fine. You know, it's out with some other presses. It's, you know, I'll just wait on them. Totally expected an answer like that. And then about 6 months later, he came to me and said, has anybody picked up that book yet? And
wow, why the change?
He did read it. And,
oh, he read it by that time, okay.
And he was really excited about it, and he was really nervous somebody else had picked it up, which felt great.
Wow.
And I said, oh, no one else has responded yet, so, you know, if you're interested, let's go all in. And I like that it came about that way, that it wasn't through our friendship that he said, oh, yeah, welcome on board. But it was through the book itself. It was the manuscript that did it, that felt right.
And it was the manuscript, right, Joshua? It wasn't you looking at him in a
certain way. Yeah, yeah, no, no. Yeah.
You will publish it.
Right, yeah. No, I didn't try any techniques on him. But yeah, he's a... You know, very respectful. He doesn't force any edits. He wants everything to be ultimately the author's decision, and how involved he is part of that decision as well. But he's an editor who likes to be really involved. And I was really open to that. And so he had a big part in this manuscript, and especially in terms of organization. That was a big one. A lot of these essays.
How to structure it.
How to get all this.
The sequencing, the essays. Yeah,
all this differing material to work together. And not so both sequencing and changing certain aspects of essays to taking out material that was repeated or making the through line clearer, which is something I was having trouble with on my own. So I sort of knew the problems of the manuscript, and I just needed someone like Michael to really
confirm what you were
confirm those and find solutions that I couldn't find. And one that he suggested that was a pretty big change was that many of these were written, if not fully, more so in the past tense and the present tense. And he said, what if we move some of these that have bits of the present tense to be almost fully present tense, so that we see an ever-evolving now of the book? Because there is a chronology within the book, but we don't make
it. Starting with you seeing God as a child, too.
Sure, yeah. but just that through the retinal hemorrhages and the eye injections, that in this book is about a 10-year period. And just being able to see it, starting with Hazy, which is at the beginning of that, and then moving through. So some of those essays that deal with PXC and PXC-related symptoms,
yeah,
specifically.
Yeah, the Pixies and the Conference is towards the end, one of the last essays.
Yeah, and so that's time-wise, that's about a decade after Hazy. But both of those are in present tense. So there's maybe this... Hopefully this feeling, we tried inserting dates and things like that into certain places in the manuscript and took most of those out, where we didn't want to be so explicit with time mark, or not that we didn't want to be so explicit, but we didn't want the reader to get hung up on dates, to be, oh, where are we in time now? Mm-hmm. Because we wanted that narrative line, that arc from beginning to end, but we didn't want it ultimately, as we discussed, isn't a memoir, and so that we didn't want the reader to have to keep up you know, okay, how old exactly is the author now and where are we in time? So the present tense we're hoping would cause the reader to kind of have that experience of moving through time and having the now of the book changing over time as that narrative was dropping out and reappearing. So that was really helpful. And it's not something I would have come up with on my own, even though I was using present tense more than I had previously in this book already. I was being more selective about when it appeared. It would come in at the end of the essay or something, mm-hmm. where you know, I would bring, it would be, I'd be telling a story in the past tense and then bring the reader into the now of me writing it, whenever that mm-hmm. was. And he was like, well, why don't we just pull that out? And so working with him, I mean, had such a creative hand in this. And the copy editor, Asa Grigsby, she did so much work too, and far more than your average copy editor. And really, I think she deepened the book in many ways as well, and was doing a lot of the work of a sensitivity reader to an editor that would read for...
So not just fixing grammar and mm-hmm. misspellings, and a lot more of a contribution.
Yeah. Yeah, and even pointing out some places were a touch more structural, and that maybe we should look at before finalizing. And yeah, I think the only time I'd had a similar experience was when I wrote an essay for Tin House when it was still a journal, and getting put through their editors, and the level, what, you know, a copy edit at Tin House is a very different experience than a copy edit anywhere else.
And it was a wonderful magazine.
Yeah, I mean, it was
much missed.
I felt like I was getting a free class just through the editing process with them, because it was so deep and so wise. And that's how it felt working with Asa. She really did deepen the book in a way that the word copy editor doesn't really describe.
Well, Josh, I want to close with a quote from Helen Keller, which you included in the book's last essay. The keenness of our vision depends not on how much we can see, but on how much we feel. Thanks for talking with us today.
Thanks so much, Ken. Really appreciate it.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had one, you can listen anytime, on demand, at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, Jonesy, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Joshua James Amberson, author of the new book, Staring Contest, Essays About Eyes, from Portland's Perfect Day Publishing. Joshua will be reading and signing books at the Independent Publishing Resource Center in Portland on Friday, June 9th. You can learn more about his work and all his upcoming events online at joshuajamesamberson.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, June 8th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying...
KBOO's it's a pillar of the kind of, I guess, the radio community here in town, but also just kind of the weirdo community.